It's time for Lunch Hour Reviews.
He was licking me.
What?
He was licking me!
Lunch Hour Reviews.
This man ate until he burst.
I'm painting me.
It's feeding time.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rance Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rance Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
So on this episode of Lunch Hour Reviews, we're going over a couple, and this time around, we both saw most of them together. So
yeah.
It'll be a little more comprehensive.
It's rare that we're watching the same ones just for fun, though.
Yeah, usually we're warning each other not to watch certain movies. And we've only got one of those this time.
Yay!
So we're covering Goodnight Mommy, the Austrian film from last year, and also Welcome to Leith and Ava's Possession.
Yeah.
When he first got here, he turned around and asked me, did we have any land for sale?
I had no idea what his ultimate plan was.
Well-known white supremacist Craig Cobb plans to turn Leith into a white nationalist community.
Here we can gather together and become a simple majority by legal electoral rights.
We live here, we breathe here, our kids grow up here.
That's white Americans hating on us, who are also white Americans.
This is what we sleep with every night.
They simply will not allow us to keep one another's company freely and openly.
You shall be, I will hit you.
He posts my name, my address. We gotta go.
Nazi people, I think they're all snakes. You got to cut their head off to get rid of them.
If we weren't getting harassed so much, we wouldn't have to do this.
You're running us out of this damn town.
So Welcome to Leith is new on Netflix streaming.
Yeah.
And it was highly recommended for my viewing. I'm not entirely sure why. I guess I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately.
Yeah, that's, I mean, because I only watch horror or documentary.
Yeah.
Mostly documentaries about horrific things.
Yeah, and the day Pixar makes a horror movie, you're in like
Quinn. Forget about it. Forget about it. No, this was one I think I found on, I was kind of going down a rabbit hole of Netflix documentaries.
Yeah.
I'm doing that a lot.
From the cover, I thought it was a narrative piece about like neo-Nazis and whatnot, but it turns out it's a documentary. It's not as scary as it sounds initially.
It's scary after you think about it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it does make a couple broader cultural statements. But so we're talking about Welcome to Leith, and it's directed by Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher K. Walker.
Yeah.
This is the synopsis. Welcome to Leith is a feature documentary chronicling the attempted takeover of a small town in North Dakota by notorious white supremacist Craig Cobb. Filmed in the days leading up to Cobb's arrest for terrorizing the townspeople on an armed patrol and his subsequent release from jail 6 months later, the film is an eerie document of American DIY ideals.
Right.
That's a funny way to describe it, but I guess it's a very specific story, so I guess it's kind of, I don't know. It's tough to give it context.
And because I think also because we watched Green Room so recently,
yeah,
we have like neo-Nazis on the brain, I feel.
Yeah. It's funny that Green Room, especially being led by Patrick Stewart, who like, Jesus Christ, just oozes charisma.
Right, right.
These guys come off as like a couple slack-jawed yokel kind of twerps.
Because they are.
Yeah, yeah. So Craig Cobb is our like lead baddie, and he is backed by the National Socialist group? What is the?
Yeah, nationalist, right?
It's a white supremacist.
Yeah, it doesn't. Group. They're neo-Nazis out of
incidentally
Detroit.
They are the like hardcore, have their shit together, scary influence.
They
in
are
this movie.
Suit and tie kind of guys, but they're also big guys. You know what I'm saying? They're like they're tough. You can imagine these guys in a suit, but you say, oh, on the weekends you wear your red suspenders and your boots.
Yeah.
You know,
and I noticed during one of the press reports where the guy, I think he might have been there to like support Cobb in court, he shows up in his, you know, sort of standard black suit and tie. And that jacket was some Nazi shit. That was some Hugo Boss 1940 shit.
Oh, really? I didn't.
Yeah, it was intense. But yeah, so the story is about Craig Cobb buying up territory in the town of Leith. And
this is a town of about, they say, I thought they said 28 people, but on their website, Leith has its own website. There's like 19 people in this town.
Is it that small? Wow. Okay. Yeah, he talks about how he bought a plot of land next to his house for $500.
Yeah, and then he goes up and buys
cheap real estate.
Way more plots of land because Leith doesn't know what hit him at this point in time. They think someone's buying a bunch of land. That's great for us.
Yeah, and I don't know if legally they can deny someone purchase on account of like a character reference.
Well, later on, let's say after this movie. This movie was all done in 2013, and afterwards, Craig Cobb has to kind of go to jail. These things happen. Last summer, he started doing this to another town, and that town calls up Leith and says, how did you get this guy out of your town?
Yeah.
And what they did was the city bought the plots of land and wouldn't sell it.
Okay.
So it was a workaround.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. You know, of course, Cobb's not going to hold his tongue. But what we do see on account of all the footage in the documentary is the sort of character change that happens when it's Cobb's side and that footage differing from the documentarians or the local photographer
anyone
guy who's taken up.
Yeah, yeah, anyone video with a brain has one side of this, and then there's the rest.
And so, yeah, so we get to see Cobb, and I don't have the guy's name, but this sort of lackey dope who follows him around. We've got, like, their cell phone footage.
Right.
And in their minds, like, they're protecting their civil liberties because
well,
this is all about free speech.
They videotape, like, everything. Craig Cobb is the videotape king. And he works, you know, for Vanguard and other crazy outlets like that. And so it's like he's always filming and he understands, very similar to Fred Phelps, understanding the law in a sinister kind of way. And so, they have tons of film from their point of view.
And because in their mind, they are, you know, they are on God's side, they volunteer this footage. I'm sure a lot of it was sort of taken for the purposes of the court trial because, you know, the crimes he's accused of are right there on camera.
Right. And they put it up on YouTube. He has a YouTube channel as well as working for Vanguard and releasing it to other outlets. Like, the thing that I think was so terrifying about this movie, what's so scary about it is there's all these people talking and connecting that we don't have any clue. You know what I'm saying? It's a completely different world.
You mean like his support network?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like something I don't really think about, obviously, but it's terrifying to know that it's just going right next to, I'm watching a video of cats and then maybe like someone right next to me on the train is watching this crazy shit.
Yeah, yeah, and we do get, because the documentary consists of video footage, news footage, pulls from radio call-in shows that are like, you know, white nationalist call-in shows, the narrator, like, there is no editorial through line. There is no, you know.
It just is. It's presented as it is.
Occasionally there's text on screen to explain, like, times and places, but otherwise, like, this is just the document of the time and place. And we don't need anything more. And I was thinking about that. One of the reasons Cobb would be like eager to volunteer the footage is because he looks at the same footage as we're looking at, and he's going like, "Well, I'm right. Like,
right, exactly.
Anybody can see that.
It's very similar to the Fred Phelps film, that documentary that was so popular about him. And they watched it with the Phelps family, and they were like, "That's a great depiction of us.
Came off quite well."
Exactly. And I think
the rest of the country is cringing.
Exactly. I think though, in this way, this film is an excellent documentary because it doesn't tell you what to think. And so someone else might watch it the exact same way that I'm watching it and think a completely different way about it,
I
guess.
Yeah, I was thinking about
that. And I think that's what makes, to me, like a really great documentary.
Yeah, and the documentary is playing an interesting game in its own right because it is, you know, it's a film. It is art. It is a documentary. And it is working along the lines of free speech.
Right.
And that is exactly the same language that we see coming out of the mouths of these white supremacists. These racists only thrive on account of the First Amendment, and they really throw that in people's faces on
a
regular basis.
They know their rights. They definitely do. I think another thing that's kind of interesting about this, these two, Michael Beach Nichols and Christopher Walker, had heard that this was going on. They read about it in a paper. they're the first two to go up there and like really start investigating this kind of, and just showing these people's lives. And this was a Kickstarter film. They were asking for $60,000. They got $64,000. Excellent.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it, I don't know. It's like the Chinese proverb about may you live in interesting times, that like, that's a bad thing. Like you kind of want things to be boring and calm, tranquil. But this is kind of a fascinating look. And I think especially the political climate and sort of what we're seeing out of like certain Trump rallies and the like just the hair trigger violence that's just kind of seething and bubbling under the surface. This is like they've pulled away the surface. We're just seeing all like the really dirty, ugly impulses of, you know, someone. And we were talking about it that Cobb is actually Canadian. He's a Canadian American.
He's a Canadian American, yeah.
So as far as like standing out from the norm, like that's twice so. Like, have you ever met a nasty Canadian in your life? Like,
no.
They don't. They hide those. They don't let them out.
Like that's what when we were talking before we started recording, I was, and I had, you know, like, oh my God, he's Canadian. And he had gotten in trouble in Canada for saying hateful shit and doing hateful things. And I was like, do they even have a law for that in Canada? Because does that ever happen? You know? And I know that's like, clearly that happens everywhere. It's something about the world, you know, wanting, I don't know, something about the world that just points out differences in people. And it's, everyone's got to be an asshole no matter where you are. But it's kind of weird to imagine a Canadian doing it.
Canadian judge says, say you're sorry. Say you're sorry, eh? And that's it. That's the end of story. But in this case, yeah. So Craig Cobb, we watch him set out on this patrol, armed to the teeth, him and his lackey,
right.
Also being followed by the lackey's wife, who's
right.
filming it all, and they're antagonizing their neighbors. So like,
they're walking down the middle of the street, which this town has, it
dirt
seems,
roads.
Dirt roads.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not even paved roads, but they're starting shit with all the neighbors. The neighbors starting shit with them. Everyone's starting shit with each other.
Yeah. And at this point, like, it's not everybody, a town of, what did you say, 18 or 19 people?
Yeah, 19 people.
19 people. Everyone knows everybody.
Exactly.
So, yeah, there's no question, like, they weren't patrolling for security's sake.
No, they were doing it to piss people off and terrorize the community.
Yeah, and apparently that's the one thing the government does take seriously is terrorism these days.
Yes.
So that, like, is an outright, you know, hostile, you know, sort of an attack on the town. And so they're arrested for that, and that sort of gets the ball rolling. That is kind of the crux of the movie, is the sort of difference between free speech and
being a
terrorism,
bully.
Being a bully, like inciting a riot.
Right.
So while Cobb is in prison,
yeah.
The townspeople kind of figure out.
Well, he sells his stuff. He sells his plot of land.
Does he? The house is now on someone else's property?
The town buys it. He
okay.
deeds everything back over to the town except for three plots of land that still, to this day, are owned by. One of them is owned by Metzger, who's a big white supremacist, okay. another white supremacist that I think is in jail for killing somebody now, but I can't remember if he's the guy in the film. And then the third one is the guy from Detroit.
Okay.
So they still own plots of land in that town.
I think they're the townspeople's original idea was sort of recognizing that like this, his home is so remote that it doesn't even have plumbing, running water,
right.
or electricity.
Which is
right?
weird to me because he was living there for a while, pissing them off, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah. It's, I don't know.
Like, what
really
is he doing? And that family, their house didn't have any water
they
either.
They had a lot of kids. Yeah.
Did they? I only think there was the one.
No, they've got at least two, maybe three.
But there's no running water in these houses, and I thought, like, they
That's
lived
gross.
There for a while.
Yeah, it's just like eternal camping, and North Dakota gets fucking cold.
Yeah, I know.
So the town figures out that if we make an ordinance that requires every home to have running water and electricity,
right.
then they are on the outs, and we might get this property back.
Right.
And so they kind of take the ground out from under them. Just as, I don't know, I mean, I'm all for free speech, and I recognize that, like, it is a zero-sum game, and it, you know, there's going to be a lot of oppositional voices.
Sure.
And we've got to take that into consideration. I think this guy crossed the line in a number of places, and I, of course, I have far less sympathy for hate speech.
Right, obviously. Because, I mean, that is...
But it was pretty sneaky on the town's part.
It's excellent because this was a town. The reason he kind of chooses this town is there's no infrastructure in this government of this town. It's just a guy who it was his turn to be mayor next because the other mayor, I think, died or retired or something. And so then it was this guy's turn. And that guy will be mayor until he decides to retire or die or whatever. And so... they didn't have any city ordinances because I think to myself, like people who I know who live in homeowners association areas, you can't even have, you know, a blue door or something. Like, how are you allowing these people to put these flags out in their yards? Swastikas everywhere, signs of swastikas, signs of Nazi shit everywhere.
They were painting them on trees. Like, I've never
outrageous.
Felt so bad for a tree. I'm like, it didn't opt to have that swastika.
That tree didn't
on
do
it.
Nothing.
Yeah, so that's one to check out. We haven't spoiled anything, and these characters, it does really show in a good amount of insight to these characters in, you know, what amounts to like behind the scenes behavior.
Yeah.
And if
you go see Welcome Green Room, follow it up with Welcome to Leith.
Yeah, that would be interesting two-parter if you have the patience for that. But I think after seeing Green Room, you probably want a break. You want to relax and like calm down a little while.
Yeah, it does rile you up. It does.
So the next movie is Goodnight Mommy, and came out in 2014. I remember seeing the trailer, and now it's such a faint memory, but I do remember the feeling I got from it.
Yeah.
And it was eerie.
Mama?
The trailer's still on YouTube, because I went back and watched the trailer, because I thought, after I watched the movie, I said... I think this was a different movie. And then I went back and watched it, and I said, oh, no, they're just trying to trick me. Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was showing it from a different angle. And that it's an interesting statement on this movie as it is in terms of, like, what angle you are viewing it through.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told you that when I watched it the second time, I found it fascinating.
Sure.
What your eyes are drawn to and what you are trying to pick apart changes pretty dramatically. I'm getting ahead of myself. Goodnight Mommy was written and directed by Veronica Franz and Severin Fiala. I hope I didn't butcher those too badly. The writer-director team first got together 17 years ago when Fiala, then a film student, would babysit Franz's children in return for VHS rentals.
Okay.
Not a bad deal.
No, all right.
This is a quote. We'd have these crazy marathons, Fiala explains with a smile. One time we watched Cassavetes' Faces, Tetsuo 2, Body Hammer, Lancelot du Lac, and Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, back to back. So the movies, I will say, it's a really good blend of a couple different styles of horror.
Yeah, definitely.
I think the through line is sort of like psychological questioning and occasional... torture.
Yeah, I would say definitely it becomes torture porn. The last 30 to 40 minutes, it is. And I've read so many different people's opinions on this film, and they're like, no, it's not. And to me, yes, it is.
I think it is, but it's never singularly that. I think I would have lost interest if it was only that thing.
Well, I think it saves it to the last 30 and 40 minutes. It's psychological up to then torture porn. Ending.
Well, I think even when it goes there, it's not wholehearted, just embrace the gore. Mm-hmm. But okay, we'll get into it all. So, simple movie. It's on one, you know, sort of plot of land,
right.
A very fancy house, and I assume Vienna. I looked it up.
Yeah,
we've had a couple downloads in Vienna. We've got far more in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So, hello, Germany. And
Guten
but
Tag,
I think
right?
over yeah. So in Vienna, their house is like in the middle of a cornfield.
Yeah, it's a farming community. There's woods. There's all sorts of shit.
You get the impression it's probably like their second home.
Right.
Their mother, played by Suzanne, I'm guessing that W is meant to be pronounced as a V, so Vuest, is the mother, and people would recognize, I mean, from the trailer, she is the one in the bandages. And her two sons in the movie are actual twins, named after their actual names, Elias and Lucas. This is how it's described. An Austrian art house horror film about 11-year-old twin boys who suspect their mother, fresh from cosmetic surgery and cocooned in gauze, is an imposter. So the twin boys, I think one of the earliest shots is them playing in the cornfields.
Yeah, that's where it kind of opens up.
Yeah, and it's funny, Rachel called out, maybe you could speak to this, you're quite familiar
about how it would hurt to run through the cornfield.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that.
I know. Every time I see people running through cornfields on film, on TV, on anything, I think
sharp leaves.
That's you are running through a bunch of pieces of paper. Essentially, ooh, you're just asking for tons and tons of paper cuts as you run.
And these are little kids in the summer, so they are sleeveless.
That's something that like irritates the
crap out
of me.
Do they have softer corn in Vienna? Is that not?
I don't think so. I think corn is corn, right? Shit, those kids have tough skin. I'll say that, I guess.
So they're just doing what kids do. And I mean, anybody with siblings, and especially those with twins, know that like you have a rapport that's going to seem a little curious to outside parties.
Sure.
Like your shorthand is just, I mean, some twins even invent their own language. It's common enough. And these are two kids who are very tight. They kind of like, you know, they horse around, they play games, but they're latchkey kids.
Yeah.
They've been around on this house. It's funny. They don't really describe who was there before mom watching them. But when mom shows up and immediately their suspicion is raised.
Right.
The suspicion I mentioned in the synopsis could be categorized as Capgras delusion. I've got a little Wikipedia detail here. The Capgras delusion is a disorder in which a person holds a delusion that a friend, spouse, parent, or other close family member, or pet, has been replaced by an identical-looking imposter. The delusion most commonly occurs in patients diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, but has also been seen in patients suffering from brain injury and dementia.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I've heard of face blindness, but this is like some next-level skepticism.
I have a friend who I hope doesn't listen to this, actually, and he tells of stories. Just he grew up in a kind of a really bad house, and he tells of stories where his parents were so cold to him growing up. They were just so cold, and he would see how people were on TV and families were supposed to interact.
Yeah,
he said for years he actively thought they might be robots.
His parents were robots.
Yeah, and like he really, as a child, entertained this idea that his parents were robots because they were so cold. And so this is a kind of interesting idea because this mom is a piece of work.
Yeah. Yeah. She's creepy. There are a couple very odd. So, I mean, before all this happens, you get the sense that like this wasn't an ideal like life. Like it's just kind of a mess by the time we're getting started with the mother introduction. So I want to jump back a little bit. Just being kids a little skewed in terms of their interest. They collect cockroaches.
Yeah, disgusting, seeming like hissing cockroaches. Where do they get these things?
Well, that's I think that much is kind of purely the film. So I recognize the cockroaches as the same ones that you see in other movies.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're right, they're Madagascar hissing cockroaches.
This isn't in Austria, right?
No.
Because I would never want to go.
Unless they got loose from like someone making a film and importing cockroaches.
Oh my God, could you imagine?
But they're like slow lumbering cockroaches,
yes.
So they're kind of easy to track on a film set.
Right.
But in any case, they're repulsive, and these kids have like a fish tank full of them.
Like cockroach on top of cockroach, swimming in cockroaches.
Yeah, yeah. They also find a cat to adopt, and I mean, none of this ends well.
No.
It is a horror movie.
Yeah, that doesn't end well. The cat is very like, not well when they find it.
Yeah. It was probably better off on its own. I don't remember.
Yeah.
Do they find it in a field in an abandoned house?
They find
or something?
It in like abandoned, because also.
Like a barn?
Yeah, they're going to all these crazy dangerous things. They're in this like cave or some shit. I don't even know where they go. They go wandering around in the forest, which forests in Austria and Germany seem like really dangerous because there seem to be like witches, houses, bunkers, all sorts of shit out there.
There's a moment that stood out to me when the mother is getting more and more frustrated with the kids. In this case, they've locked their door and they won't let her in. And apparently there's a policy. They're not allowed to do that. And so the mother's very angry that it takes them so long. What's actually happening is they're hiding the cat under the bed.
Right.
Because they don't want to know. Because
they think she'll kill it.
Is
the
angry.
Idea is like that she's evil.
Yeah, as far as they're concerned, like this is a creepy stranger in their home. Who
right.
knows what she's capable of?
Right, right.
So when they eventually do let her in, the kid is like throwing a tantrum. And the mother, in a really animalistic way, like pins him with her whole body.
Yes.
Like, mashes him down into the bed. And I'm thinking that, like, I've heard that as like, a play for dog owners to discipline the dog.
To put
to
it
like
down. Yeah.
Put it down, get on top of it, and maybe even bite its ear if you're a weirdo. But she does this to her child. She smothers this kid. And, I mean, for better or worse, the kid stops screaming and being a maniac.
He does knock it off. Because he was acting like a maniac, too.
So maybe the mother's actually got some insight that we don't.
Exactly, exactly. Because let's say that this is not some creepy person who's being an imposter of mom. Mom is really pissed off right now.
Yeah, yeah. And if you were looking at it from the mother's perspective, they're dicks. These kids are assholes.
They are, yeah. It depends on whose side you want to look at it, what time in the film, because most of the time, you know, like, mom, she's a real bitch, but if you were this mom with this imposter, you'd be like, God damn, these kids. They're so fucking annoying. I think one of my favorite things about this film is the way that it's filmed. Mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful. Each one, that's that mise-en-scene quality.
It's
a painting.
Colorful.
It's so beautiful. And to me, the very first, in the very beginning, even when they're running through the corn, then there's a beautiful lake shot as well. And it really strikes me as that German, Austrian, Bavarian kind of fairy tale, that Grimm's fairy tale. And you have these two, you know, twins, these two very close brothers, and an evil, wicked mother.
Yeah. And one could even sort of draw that analogy out that every time, whether they're just playing on their own or trying to escape, they have to, like, cross those woods.
Exactly.
And that is their sort of transition from, like, this, you know, awful, you know, this evil stepmother kind of scenario to trying to get help in the outside world. And, like, you know, it's not met with, you know, open arms. But it does kind of represent, like, they're trying to get themselves out of this scenario and fight against it. But yeah, it is a gorgeous film, and not easy to do when your settings are a house, a field, and you get a little bit of the woods and the outside town, a little bit. But the filmmakers made a big fuss that it had to be shot on 35mm film. They're kind of, I guess, purists in that form. And so, like, strict attention has been paid to the colorization.
It's beautiful.
When they walk into town and it's like, I mean, it's almost like an old Western where this town is empty and these two little boys are just walking down these streets. It does look like a painting.
Right. And that's, to me, it just was so much a fairy tale. Mm. And you really think of these Bavarian kind of fairy tales. And this is, at the beginning, what seems to be a very straightforward evil mother's two twins kind of a thing, doppelgangers, things like that. It's a very German story.
Yeah. Yeah. I really loved it. I think a cynical horror fan will see the twist coming pretty early.
Yes.
But that said, I even was thrilled with it upon the second viewing.
I didn't mind it, even though, I mean, I saw it for what it was. Mm. Right away. And I was fine with that. I didn't mind it, actually.
Yeah, it didn't take me out of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I love the story because it goes what you think is happening and then what happens. It's like, it gets insane. And the torture porn area is very torture porny, I'm not going to lie. But God, it's graphic and it's makes you really, really uncomfortable. It's everything that torture porn is supposed to do.
Yeah, well, I think, so we mentioned that early on, and so my only issue, I mean, it certainly goes into those elements and there's a body horror component, but when they've built up tension, it's funny, I don't get riled up by torture porn, but like visceral gore used selectively and, you know, sort of as the culmination of these tense moments, mm-hmm. It doesn't even need to be violent. There's a moment where one of the boys throws water in the mom's face, and I fucking lurched back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because it is, at that point, as shocking to the viewer it is at the mom, where you're just, like, splashed with water out of nowhere. You weren't expecting it.
Right.
And it really is this, like, act of aggression.
Yeah.
And so I kind of enjoyed that. I think the tension is a little more complicated than just, you know, your sort of generic torture porn, but that's kind of why I loved it, that it's sort of, it works between these obvious lines that it was really effective.
Yeah, it was definitely probably one of the better films I've seen in a while. I would say for Netflix, non-documentary, it's probably the best one I've seen in the last month.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I thought it covers similar territory with last year's movie, The Boy, written by Clay McLeod Chapman, mm-hmm. who's on this podcast. And just playing against the innocence of children and that sort of era of childhood where, you know, whatever, we're human beings. We give kids the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And when they start playing against that expectation, things get pretty creepy.
Right.
And also just a heads up, the Faculty of Horror, I think two episodes back, they did an episode using The Babadook and Goodnight Mommy as comparison pieces of children and the mother-child dynamic in horror movies. So check that one out, The Faculty of Horror. Sorry. All right. So wrapping up in this last one, I feel bad that I'm bringing it down, but I watched Ava's Possessions.
This is not a good one to end on, I guess.
I didn't watch this. Yeah, and I would advise against it. I mean, if you run through everything else on Netflix, there are worse ways to spend your time, I guess.
No, I would just watch these final hours over and over and over again.
So Ava's Possessions is new to Netflix streaming. It came out in 2015. It's written and directed by Jordan Galland, and it stars Louisa Krauss, William Sadler, and Carol Kane would
it's
be familiar faces.
Carol Kane? That's yeah. not, like, how bad can it be?
Right. I mean, she's acting. I was thinking, like, she's not her role in Kimmy Schmidt. She's
yeah, but, you know.
But yeah, so here's a quick synopsis. Ava Dopkins is recovering from demonic possession. With no memory of the past month, she is forced to attend a Spirit Possession Anonymous support group as Ava struggles to reconnect with her friends, get her job back, and figure out just how bad things got. She's also plagued by nightmarish visions. The demon is trying to come back.
You need to learn to be a little more cutthroat.
Well, when I was possessed, I cut some throats. No, really. I was possessed. Hi, everybody. My name's Ava.
Vanquish this diabolical!
My demon was exorcised on Tuesday.
It's like AA for people like you.
Once you've been possessed, you are 10 times more likely to be repossessed.
You acted like a mega bitch while you were possessed.
And a slut. Which is fine.
Bloody maniac running through the streets, hurting people, will usually go to jail.
Jail?
Yeah.
What are you gonna do about picking up the pieces of your life?
Is anyone calling sick for me? Forces like these, they leave their mark.
Just hope there are no more surprises.
Good luck with that.
So they treat it like it's a normal, everyday
it's
thing.
More and more common, yeah.
Okay.
And so
I like that.
It's a great premise.
You know?
It really, okay, if this was a half an hour long, it would make for a great episode of, say, M. Night Shyamalan's revamped Tales from the Crypt.
Uh-huh.
But there's so much happening that's not really... They go so heavy-handed with the addiction allegory. And so these support groups are essentially AA groups. And uh-huh. you hear these people's experiences where, you know, they're talking about spirit possession and demon possession. Outside of that group, it would be their drug of choice.
Sure.
And you get this ongoing comparison of what it felt like to be possessed and the sort of thrill and to be living every day as it's your last. And these, you know, most of these spirits are mischievous, but not, you know, all out murderous.
Okay. All right.
So you get the comparison of what it feels like to be in that state and then what everybody else is watching.
Okay.
Because it's a pretty stark difference. In Ava's case, the movie, I think the opening credits happen showing glimpses of her possession, and it's very Exorcist where the priest is casting out the demons. She's surrounded by her family. She's, you know, squabbling on the bed and making a big fuss.
Nice.
By the end of the credits, she is out of it, surrounded by her parents who have been through some shit. Her dad has a huge gash on her neck.
Oh, shit.
Her apartment is fucking wrecked. Her mom has an eye patch.
Oh, shit.
Like, it's bad. And for her not to have any memory of the experience, it really, like, can you imagine how frustrating it is to have a month blanked from your history and then you are accountable for everything you did in those days? So she's having to put all the pieces back together, and there's kind of a mystery as to, like, what really went wrong. She's got a strange man's watch stuck in her couch cushions, and yeah. So it goes a number of different places. It's meant to be kind of a horror comedy, but it's not funny. Really funny enough, and it's not really scary enough that it's – I mean, its biggest crime is that it's kind of blah. It's like bland oatmeal. And so – we talked about the premise, like, this – I love those stories where it is the aftermath of a tragic event and, you know, characters trying to hold their life together or put them back together. And in this case, like, they kind of squander that. It's kind of – I don't know. The story they chose to tell is less interesting than the premise they sort of wrote out at the beginning.
Yeah, because I love when people treat supernatural things as totally normal in film. And that's a very Spanish film genre kind of thing to do.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Especially in Mexican literature, they love to treat, you know, supernatural things in certain stories like it's run of the mill everyday shit, and I love that idea, but
yeah,
it's disappointing.
It could have gone better, and there are those elements where they, you know, only a few outsiders are completely unfamiliar with the idea of possession.
So
this is kind of like, this is like a Marvel movie where they've already introduced superheroes and we're just living
this
in that world
now. This is a normal
now.
Thing now.
Yeah. So her going to the group is actually like court mandated. It's either you submit yourself to these groups and, you know, it's kind of like court mandated recovery or Alcoholics Anonymous.
Sure.
In this case, she can either do the jail time for all the like assaults she committed, all the like property damage, all the like sexual assaults she committed. Like, she goes off the rails.
Wow.
So the court already sort of well familiar and, you know, has the vocabulary to deal with these scenarios, tells her that yes, you can either go to the group or you can go to jail, but there's got to be some penalty. So that's kind of the crux of the movie, is her figuring out how to deal with, like, you know, the like junkie's call to the drug, and, you know, fighting that and figuring out life skills and putting her life back together. But yeah, I don't know. It's all less interesting than it could be.
It sounds interesting kind of when you're telling it to me right now.
And that's why I was really excited. The first 20 minutes are great. They set up the premise.
I watch hundreds of meh movies all the time.
Well, this is a meh movie, which I don't know. It's pretty at times, but it even drives that into the ground, that like the combination of like clashing neon colors and even conspicuous when there's a scene in a car and our exterior shot of said car is the illuminated backlights that are just like blaring this fluorescent red, which only happens when you have your foot on the brake of the car.
Right.
Which you wouldn't do if you're parked having a conversation. Well, it's just, there are moments like that that call attention. They're like, oh, this is form over function.
Okay.
So yeah, I would say skip that unless you're, you know, really run through just about everything else on Netflix, which if you have, good on you, who's got that kind of time. Otherwise, avoid it.
All right, so that's it for this Lunch Hour review. Sorry to end on a crappy one, Darren. Bad programming.
Well, I tried to make it entertaining, but yeah, ultimately it's a warning to stay away from this one.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
I'm not recommending a terrible film.
Well, if you want to know more about us, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Rants Macabre. We have an email address. It's therantsmacabre@gmail.com. So send us an email. I like to open them. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
We recently got one so that we could invest in gold.
Excavated gold out of Africa. It wasn't even from a deposed prince of Nairobi.
I know.
Wherever.
Which, like, yeah, I don't even know his credentials. And if you're not the prince of some country that I've never heard of.
No, thanks.
Then I'm not interested. Is that it? Facebook? Oh, go to our website, too. Sorry.
Yeah.
And you can go to our website, therantsmacabre.com.
Yep. We are on all the streaming. I think we got to figure out getting on to Spotify, but we are now on Google Play Music.
Which is cool. Google Play is actually kind of cool.
It is. I find it more effective than iTunes for streaming audio.
Yeah.
So find us also on iTunes. While you're there, if you know, ignore my crapping on it, drop us a review. It goes a long way in trying to get us up the ranks. And where else? Stitcher. We're on Stitcher Radio,
yeah.
Internet radio. They also collect reviews if you're feeling so generous. but yeah, you've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network, produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com. That's it for me. This is Darren signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.